Get up, cowboy! The words jolted me. Cowboy was my old combat call sign from when I ran with the Department of Military Sciences, but the voice I heard speaking to me there in that cell did not belong to one of my former Spec Ops colleagues, no. Nor was the use of the nickname related to my job. This was the voice of the person who'd hung that name on me a long, long time ago. A voice that could not be here, not now, not ever. Go away, I said.
Screw that, said the voice. Get your sorry butt up or I'm telling Mom.
No, 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 my mind growled. Aloud, I said, you can't be here, Sean. You can't. There was the scuff of a foot and then the creak of mattress coils as someone sat down on the bed. It took so much of everything I had left to open my eyes, to turn, to see my brother sitting there. He looked the way he had when we were kids. He was wiry and had the look of combined exasperation and humor he wore whenever I did something dangerous or stupid. Or both. Like when I tried to base jump from a tree using a parachute made from black plastic trash bags, or when I tried for a somersault into the pool at school. He had skeptical eyes and a scuffle of sandy hair and a scar on his jaw from when he'd run halfway through a privet hedge while we were playing frisbee in the front yard. Sean, my only brother, blown to red rags on Christmas Eve, bones in a box and laid to rest between our father and Sean's wife and kids. No, I said, you're not here. He shrugged.
You say that, dingus, but you're actually talking to me.
No, I'm not, I said.
Whatever, dude, you're just being weird.
And you're a ghost. Sean cocked his head to one side.
I don't know. Am I?
Or am I crazy? I asked. He spread his hands in an if-the-shoe-fits gesture. Then he tilted his face up as sunlight fell on him. There was no sunlight anywhere. There couldn't be. Just on him. I watched his shoulders rise and fall as he took a long breath and sighed it out. Without looking at me, he said,
he's coming for you.
Who? I asked. Centauro, let that motherfucker come. I want him to. Sean turned to look at me, and in the fragment of a second it took his head to turn, he changed. Now he was the Sean I'd only glimpsed on that awful day, older. 30, with the eyes of a cop whose heart had not yet been thoroughly broken by the job. Wearing an ugly Christmas sweater with a smudge of green cookie icing on his cheek from where a child might have kissed him. No, said Sean. He is coming. His eyes, which were always as blue as mine, suddenly changed. It was as if ink were leaking into the iris and sclera, tainting them, staining them with ugly shades of green and brown, as if reptile skin had been run through a blender and turned to paint. Even the darkness inside me recoiled.
He's coming for you, Joe, said Sean in a voice that was low, raspy, rumbly, and entirely obscene. If you keep hunting Santoro and Cougar, you'll find him, and he really wants you to find him, cowboy. Oh, yes, he does. He wants that so much.
As he spoke, his breath plumed out, not cold breath, but hot. It was like being next to the open mouth of a great furnace. I could feel the heat on my cheeks and lips and eyes. I recoiled in horror and fumbled for my gun. I think I screamed, but I'm really not sure. God knows I needed to. But then I blinked, and the bed was empty. And I was alone with the corpse of Casanova and my combat dog. The heat, so intense a moment ago, faded now, and I could smell the stink of piss and blood from Casanova, his bowels having emptied as his muscles slackened in death. I turned to Ghost and saw that he'd backed all the way into the corner, tail tucked between his legs, the white hair on his back standing as stiff as needles. He was panting, hard, not from effort or pain, but fear. Drool flecked his muzzle. "It's okay, boy," I said, but those words and the tone of my voice lacked all conviction. It was not okay, not even a little bit. Either I was losing what was left of my mind or the world was broken. Maybe both.
"He is coming."
I thought I knew who he was, but I didn't dare say the name. I refused to let myself think that name. "It's okay," I said, and reached a hand toward Ghost. He still trembled, but not as violently, and he summoned the courage to reach out and lick my gloved fingers. "He's not here, boy. We're okay. We're safe." It was only then I realized that the room had been utterly quiet while Sean was there. Now real sound flooded back. I could hear alarms and yelling and saw that the door had been knocked ajar. Not much, but enough to break the soundproofing seal. Thin fingers from something burning were clawing at the edges of the door, mingling with the paler dust from the jagged cracks in the ceiling and walls. Another sound punched into my awareness, coming from outside, but close. Gunfire. Chapter 98. The Talk. Phoenix House, Amphorae Island, Greece. Doc Holliday arranged for her presentation to be held at the Talk instead of her lab because it had bigger screens. Church and Wilson, together with Bug, Nikki, Yoda, and a dozen other department heads clustered around. Isaac Breslau and Ronald Coleman sat at the front near Doc, who stood and addressed the group.
"Okay," she began. "We've been going over this for weeks, and as puzzles go, it's got that old Gordian knot beat six ways from Sunday. The challenge here is that we have a lot of pieces to that puzzle, but we are only just now getting a sense of what exactly this is."
No one commented. Church nodded for her to continue.
"I'm going to give this to you point by point. Most of you know some of it because you've been working on your piece of it. I know most of it because, well, hell, guys, I'm the one giving the presentation now, aren't I?"
She picked up a small clicker and put up the first image.
"This is a 3D model of one of the exosuits based on the schematics we found. This is the K-110 fighting machine, which is the most recent one of its class described in the recovered data. Looks like a robot version of Quasimodo, all hunched over. But see there? The back is articulated, and there are servos, so the driver of this nifty gizmo can stand straight."
As they watched, the computer inserted a person into the suit, and it stood up.
"Now it looks more like the love child of Iron Man and one of those Transformer thingies," said Doc. "Or as Bug insists, something, God help me, called Battletech."
"Gundam," yelled Nikki.
"Mazinger Z," countered Yoda. "Or Super Dimensions Fortress Macross."
Scott Wilson turned and gave them a withering look until they fell silent.
"And now we have this," said Doc,
and she fed a short video clip, poor resolution and from a distance, of a single fighting machine going through its paces.
"This is footage we got from the button cam worn by Top Sims. As you can see, this isn't something they're just thinking about building. Top reports that they had several of these, and drivers, as you can see, are actively training.
She ran the footage three times.
According to the specs, continued Doc, these suits are coated with an off-market hardened shell built with layers of heat-resistant and shock-absorbing blends of natural and synthetic fibers. Similar in concept to Kevlar, Nomex, and Technora, but at least two or possibly three orders of magnitude more durable. This is a whole new class of aramids, blending polymers, graphene, spider silk, and other composite materials. Frankly, fellas, I've never seen anything like this, and I suspect no one else has. It's new, and it's almost certainly proprietary tech that is, or will soon be, the cornerstone of Kuga's line of equipment for the PMC trade.
What are its limitations? Asked Church.
There were test results in with the material Ledger gave to Toys. Unless this is science fiction, it'll stop armor-piercing bullets up to and including hardened steel, tungsten, and even tungsten carbide in a copper or cupro-nickel jacket.
Wilson said,
Good Lord.
Not sure the good Lord himself could penetrate this stuff,
said Doc.
There's a whole set of test results insisting that this thing can take an RPG in the chest and keep going.
The room was silent.
And,
said Doc brightly,
it gets worse.
How much worse? Asked Church.
Well, the unit itself has a max load capacity of 1,400 pounds, not including the driver. The carapace has fittings to attach a modified M134 minigun and two 5,000-round belts. Other nifty options include a launcher for 40x46mm grenades with an auto-feeder capable of 20 shots. That launcher can carry a variety of party favors, too, including high-explosive M441 and XM1060 thermobarics.
Wilson's face was pale, and Doc wasn't sure he'd blinked once since she started.
There's some reference to a flame unit, continued Doc, but because of tank size, my guess is that it would be attached to a second unit.
Bug cleared his throat.
So, if I'm hearing this right, we're talking about a bulletproof, flameproof personal tank? Yes, and a right sprightly one, too. There's a mode for normal pace, but if they want to push the batteries, it can run, climb stairs, and turn on a dime. So, it's a tank that can chase you up a flight of stairs, outrun you, and send you to Jesus faster than you can spit.
Doc, who was always at her most cheerful when things were at their worst, positively beamed.
Now,
she said brightly,
want to hear the really bad part?
Chapter 99 Das Verarbeitungszentrum, Cell 13. Ghost found his voice and gave a sharp bark of warning, turning his tail, whipping up, muzzle wrinkling. There were voices outside, closer than the gunfire, coming toward this cell. Two men speaking, not in German or English or in Catalan, for that matter. They spoke Romanian. I heaved myself to my feet and drew my Snellig dart gun, waving Ghost to a position where he'd be out of sight once I opened the door. My ears were still muzzy from the blast, but I was pretty sure these guys were no more than a dozen paces up the hall. I eased the door open half an inch wider and peered out. The hallway was thick with smoke, and the klaxons were much louder. I saw two figures moving toward me through the smoke. They were big and misshapen like a couple of mountain gorillas, and it took my dazed brain a moment to realize that the figures were wearing body armor of a kind that was bulkier than the sleek stuff I wore. Their words were distorted, but I caught some of it.
Este chiar aici,
said one of them in Romanian, gesturing toward cell 13. It's right here. He was the shorter of the two. Subtracting the helmet and the thick soles of combat boots, he was probably 5'10". The other guy was 4 or 5 inches taller. Both were broad-shouldered and fit. What was strange, though, is that they moved casually, like they were taking a stroll through the park on a spring afternoon. Not the physical dynamic one typically sees in a prison break, which is what I assume this was. The bigger guy said,
Spaniolo a spus că primim cu toții un bonus frumos pentru asta.
That made my pulse quicken. The Spaniard said we're all getting a nice bonus for this. The Spaniard. Rafael Santoro, son of a bitch.
Sigur, said the other. Daca vragitoria nuya totul.
Sure, if the witch doesn't take it all. The witch? I had no idea who that was and no time to think about it. They had guns in their hands, but they held them sloppily, barrels pointing nearly down at the floor like they didn't give much of a fuck about anything. I shifted the Snellig to my left and drew the Sig Sauer with my right, whipped the door open and leaned halfway into the hall, pointing one barrel at each man.
Sper che voi siate gruppati, I said.
I hope you two are undertakers. They stopped and stared at me. I couldn't see their eyes through the lenses of their goggles, but I could feel their surprise and knew they were trying to make sense of what was happening. I watched the same process with them I'd seen with Casanova. Recognition and awareness.
Ledger, said the shorter of the two, almost spitting my name. It's the diavolo.
It is the devil. The taller one said,
Foto Christos is idomnesi mati.
That doesn't translate well into English, but it's not a nice thing to say to anyone pointing a gun at you. Unsling your weapons and drop them to the ground, I told them, still speaking in Romanian. Do it right now, or I will kill you. Then they laughed and charged at me like a pair of demented bulls, like men who thought they were invincible, invulnerable. Insane. I fired both guns, and it did no damned good at all. Chapter 100. The Talk, Phoenix House, Amphorae Island, Greece. Doc Holliday clicked a new image onto the screen. It showed a man dressed in more normal body armor, helmet, chest shell, limb pads, and a stomach groin shield. This was an actual photograph of a man, presumably a fixer, in a field-testable prototype. He had a sidearm on one hip, a large fighting knife on the other, and carried a standard Special Operations Forces combat assault rifle.
Well, said Wilson weakly, at least that's a bit less frightening.
No, said Doc cheerfully. It's really not.
Chapter 101. Das Vera Beitungszentrum. The taller of the two stepped between my guns and his partner while simultaneously rushing at me. It happened in the blink of an eye. The Sandman dart exploded uselessly on his shoulder, but the 9mm round hit him center mass. Even with Kevlar, the brute force of the lead slug should have staggered him. All he did was grunt. It wasn't even a cough or cry of controlled pain. A grunt. Like a bullet fired from 5 feet away was, at most, an irritant.
Oh. Shit.
I stepped forward and raised the pistol to fire into his face, see how he'd like that, but then he swatted me aside. That's the best word I can think of. It wasn't a punch. It wasn't an attempt to deflect my aim before I could correct for a face shot. His hand moved so fast it was a blur, and his open palm hit the ballistic padding over my deltoid. I barely saw it coming, and the blow picked me up as surely as the explosion had and smashed me into the doorframe. I am over 6 feet and weigh north of 200, and that open-handed smack knocked me through the air as if I were a scarecrow stuffed with straw. I hit hard and dropped down to my knees, head ringing and the world doing some kind of drunken jig around me. My hands were empty and I couldn't even see where my guns went. If I'd been alone, they'd have had me, no doubt about it. But then a white missile blew past me and crunched into the tall man's stomach, doubling him more from surprise than anything. The tall guy staggered and went down, and Ghost went for his throat. The smaller man was caught in a moment of indecision, help his friend or finish me off. That split second gave me a doorway back into the fight. I pushed off the frame and tried a swat of my own to knock aside the rifle barrel he was trying to raise, but hitting his arm was like striking a seasoned oak tree. I hit hard, but all I accomplished was to move the barrel 2 inches to one side as he pulled the trigger. The bullets caught me on the side as I tried to turn to avoid them. My armor is really good, but the angle of impact was bad and the impact spun me. I took that force and let it turn me all the way around, and as I completed the pirouette, I chopped him across the point of the jaw with the bottom of my fist. Armor or no, that is a lot of torque and leverage, and the blow whipped his head to one side. It should have given him whiplash at the very least. It didn't. He cursed and pivoted back, tried for another shot, but I was moving now, my balance on the balls of my feet. Not sure what kind of body armor he had or how it could possibly have sloughed off the damage from my hit to his chin, and I didn't care. I had a tiny window of opportunity, and the killer in me was fully in the game now. The killer, not the darkness. Small mercies. I grabbed the handles of the two Randall attack knives and snap-released them with downward jerks. The matched knives had 7.5-inch Bowie-style blades and brass double guards, 14 ounces each. I usually prefer the much smaller and lighter Wilson rapid-release folding knife, but I was far from home and working with the equipment I could scrounge. These blades are excellent, and they don't give a damn about body armor. I proved that by slashing down at his forearm with one and across his face with the other. Did it the same way a samurai cuts with a sword, chopping down while drawing the blade fast and smooth, letting the length of cut give me depth of injury. Both knives bit deeply, and a reddish-gray gel of some kind oozed from the slashes. The killer did not shrug it off. No, sir, this time he screamed in pain, staggered back, and in doing so lost his grip on the rifle, which dropped to hang on its sling. Blood poured from both wounds. They were bad wounds. Very deep. The kind that awaken thousands of outraged nerve bundles and flood the brain with white-hot agony. But he didn't stop. Through the lenses of his goggles, I saw the pain register, and then I saw his eyes change. The white of his eyes suddenly seemed to darken, turning to a vicious blood red. Then he rushed me, pawing at the knives like an enraged bear. Not sophisticated movements, but so fast and strong that I lost one blade and had to do some fancy footwork to avoid him taking the other. His whole body seemed to move at a different rate of speed, faster with much quicker reflexes. I counterattacked with slashes that tore his combat gloves to ribbons. The manufacturers advertise those kind of gloves as being knife-proof. I beg to differ. Depends on the knife and the man using it. Did not stop him, though. If anything, he leveled up. Again. Christ. I moved in a rapid half-circle, avoiding a series of incredibly quick and powerful swings, keeping an empty hallway behind me instead of a wall. Ghost was still fighting the second guy on the floor. The Kevlar was slowing the dog down, but that kind of armor is necessarily thinner around the throat, allowing for mobility. Thin protection means exactly jack squat against a big dog with titanium teeth. There was a lot of blood. But no screams. The man was still fighting Ghost, despite obvious serious and savage damage. And in a flash I saw his eyes. The sclera had also turned a vivid, furious red. What the actual fuck? Everything since I'd walked into Casanova's cell felt like it belonged in the Twilight Zone. He is coming. The man I was fighting kept trying to grab my knife wrist instead of actually fighting me. It was freaky. He ripped off his goggles and tore off his balaclava as if it were all choking him. My knife had ripped him open from side to side, giving him a red smile like the Joker. Blood poured from it, splashing his clothes in the wall as he came at me with renewed vigor, red eyes blazing. But as he attacked, he made a little series of yippy noises like a child so lost in a fit of rage he was unable to form words. It chilled me. I've never seen anyone lose their shit like this before. He was clearly a trained soldier, whether regular military or private contractor, and yet there was absolute madness in his actions. It made no sense at all, even with the severity of the injuries. It was so weirdly out of place that if this were a movie, it might have been comical. But there was nothing funny in real life. He slapped and pawed and bled as I tried to chop him down. Even with all that, he was so goddamned fast. His hands blurred. I kept shifting and turning to evade his grabs. His blood spattered me, the walls, the floors. Drops of it seeded the air, punching small holes in the thickening smoke. I feinted left and shifted right, snapping out with a kick to his groin. My shoes have steel tips, and I kick really damned hard. The blow connected, and I could see the shock of it register on his face. He uttered a high-pitched whistle of pain and staggered. And so I kicked him again. And again, driving the Kevlar groin cup hard into the pubic bone. Even with the alarms ringing, I could hear bones break, and yet he kept coming. His ferocity, his animal drive absolutely terrified me. He was hunched over now, white flecks of spit on his bloody lips, his feet losing their sense of control. He was not reacting to the pain in any normal way. It seemed to both increase his pain and fury while driving him into some whacked-out headspace. I jagged to the other side and stamped down in the inside of his left knee with the flat of my heel, exploding the joint. He cried out, but in the voice of a hurt child. It was the strangest, eeriest thing I've ever heard from someone in a fight. It was as if the man I fought had retreated, and his inner child, wild and terrified, had emerged, and that was who I'd just hurt. As he fell, I followed him and stabbed downward, my blade slicing through the thin sheath of protection around his throat. He gagged, spurting dark blood from the wound and from his mouth. I whirled away from him and saw that Ghost was still fighting the other guy. I've never known my dog to have anywhere near that much trouble with anyone, body armor or not. The man was bloody and screaming, but he was still trying to win. I moved in and shouldered Ghost aside and drove the blade down like a spike, smashing through the right lens of his goggles and deep into the man's brain. Then I half-toppled away onto hands and knees. Ghost stood there, trembling with bloodlust and fear, his eyes wild. The sounds of gunfire were somewhere close by, down a hall, around a corner. I saw the Ghost was looking past me, but not in the direction of those shots. He began to snarl, and I turned to see something I would have thought impossible. With a broken knee and dozens of cuts, with a crushed pelvis and a slashed throat, the first of the men I'd fought was struggling to sit up. He pawed at a holstered pistol, still trying to fight, still trying to be alive. I gaped at him, speechless, horrified. I scrambled over and slapped his hand away from the pistol, drew it myself, put the barrel under his chin, and blew the top of his head off. He flopped back. But he still did not stop twitching. It was insane. I recoiled as an atavistic dread surged up inside me. I felt as if I were fighting something inhuman, something that could not be killed. Then I saw thin tendrils of smoke curling up from under his body armor. Ghost barked sharply, and I turned to see that he was staring at the other man. Smoke was rising from him, too. "Oh, shit!" I cried, and then I was moving. I scooped up my weapons, yelled for Ghost, and we ran. We ran really goddamned fast. We got halfway down the hall when the two dead men exploded. Chapter 102. The Talk, Phoenix House, Amphorae Island, Greece. Doc said, "Don't focus on the weapon he's carrying and look at the armor. It's similar to our best, and by that I mean my best, but as much as it twists my panties into a real tight bunch, it is better. A lot better. It's made from the same kind of composite aramid materials as is used in the K-110 fighting machine. Not as dense, so it can't take an RPG in the breadbasket and might not stop a sniper firing armor-piercing rounds, but don't bet your lunch money on it." She clicked and changed the image to a page of very technical specifications. Church leaned forward and studied the arcane notations very carefully.
From a distance, said Doc, what we're seeing is basically next-gen combat body armor. That's scary, but what makes this more frightening than the K-110 fighting machine is what's built into the armor.
She used a laser pointer to indicate a series of formulae on one side of the screen.
Each of the suits is fitted with pockets for chemicals, she said. Very similar in theme to the Thermite A91 we have in our own gear for post-action disposal when that gear cannot be recovered, but these slippery sons of bitches have gone and upped the ante. One of their mad scientists has found a way to get the big bad bang of azido-azide-azide, which has 14 nitrogen atoms, with most of them bonded to one another in successive, unstable nitrogen-nitrogen bonds, which makes them very prone to going bang. That stuff was developed by my old drinking buddy, Thomas Kaplutke, about a dozen years ago. Normally, any attempt to handle the chemical at all causes those bonds to break and turns them into multiple molecules of rapidly expanding nitrogen gas, which creates a hell of a lot of heat and boom. But these cats have found a way to stabilize it, and I wish to hell the entire formula was there, because I'd like to steal it, patent it, and sell it. Just contracts with construction companies alone would net me enough money to buy, oh, Mars and turn it into a luxury resort.
She paused.
I know I keep saying this, but it beats the living hell out of me why Cougar doesn't go straight and, like I said, patent it and become richer than God.
Because he steals the research, suggested Dr. Coleman, who was a big, burly, and bearded man in contrast to Isaac's small and slender appearance.
Yeah. Doc said. I know, just grousing. Anyway, this stuff is packed into airtight stabilizing pouches throughout the suit, about 7 pounds of it. Why do they need that much?
Asked Nikki.
Is the body armor that hard to melt down? No, said Doc. It isn't for after-action disposal. With that modified azido-azide-azide, you'd only need 3 ounces to turn the suit and occupant into smoking fairy dust. Nope. This, ladies and gentlemen, is crime and punishment here. You see, they had a tricky little system of wires synced with telemetry from modified RFID chips. As long as a person wearing the suit maintains a pulse rate above a certain number, all's fine and dandy. But if that person were to die, well, then there's a triggering mechanism that sends little electric shocks to each and every darn one of those chemical pouches. The resulting explosion from 9 pounds of that stuff? Well, if one went off in, say, a high school auditorium, then no one would be graduating that year. You see, they didn't just stabilize that chemical. They upped its kick.
She clicked back to the photo of the fixer in the body armor.
Our boy Kuga has developed the most powerful suicide vest in the history of global terrorism. If a fixer walks into any environment, he can either fire with impunity or kill as many people as he wants. Not because of the armor's toughness, and remember, it's really tough, but because anyone firing in self-defense who gets lucky and pops the guy will trigger a blast that will kill every single living thing inside of 50 yards.
She paused, letting that sink in.
Now, imagine a team of them going into North Korea's Rung Grotto 1st of May Stadium, which has a capacity of 140,000, or Michigan Stadium in Ann Arbor. That's 114,000 people dead in a flash.
Church said, "Dear God."
Where are they planning on using these things?
Asked Nikki.
That, sweet cheeks,
said Doc,
is what we don't know. And I pray to whichever deity has taken our calls that this is what our boy Joe Ledger is trying to find out.
Chapter 103.
Das Verarbeitungszentrum.
The young blonde woman with the brace on her left knee stood in the gaping hole of what had been the main entrance to the processing plant. Now it was a cavern of rubble, torn bodies, and shattered glass. A chemical stink of high explosives hung in the air, pushed around by sluggish clouds of brick dust. Twisted sheets of metal stood up like broken ribs from some gigantic corpse. Eve grinned at it. Explosions always made her happy, and she'd been told that a big one was needed to breach these walls because they were concrete reinforced with steel. That intel had been correct, and she'd made sure that the first try was enough to do the trick. The blast had been so big that it destroyed the entrance to the building. It tore a line of hedges from the ground and threw them burning into the decorative trees. Those trees now burned like a row of tiki torches. Nothing of the original doorway remained, and although the blast hadn't damaged the inner airlock, it had completely obliterated the walls into which it was set, so the airlock lay atop the rubble.
"Awesome," she gushed. "That was so rad."
A pair of heavily armored killers stood nearby, Cain and Abel.
"The team's located the cell, Miss Eve," Abel told her, his fingers still touching his comms unit.
"About time," said Eve.
She looked at her watch, which was set to mission time. It was 3 minutes since the breach. Standard response time for police at this time of night was 5 minutes, 20 seconds. Way off in the distance, she could hear a siren.
"The team's encountering some resistance inside," added Abel. "We've lost signals on 4, losing feeds on Ephraim and Asher."
As if to punctuate his comment, there was a heavy 1-2 ba-boom from inside, and a cloud of hot gas and burning debris belched out at them.
"Two down for sure," said Eve dryly. "Fucking idiots."
She gave Abel a scathing look.
"Are we still in control of the scene? Will we get the package?"
"Yes, ma'am," said Abel. "We anticipated some losses, but we still have the numbers and the advantage."
Cain said,
"And we're on schedule, Miss Eve."
"You'd better be right,"
Eve said, with a venomous sweetness.
"Because Daddy will be really unhappy if we come back empty-handed. Really fucking unhappy."
Those words drained the color from the faces of the two big men. Cain turned aside, touched his comms unit, and began growling orders. Abel might as well have turned to stone for all the expression he showed. Eve turned away to hide her smile. She loved making these boys jump. All she had to do was say boo, and they pissed their pants. Genuine toughness, she'd been taught, was not a quality of height, gender, or muscle mass. It was about potential, to reward and to punish. Eve checked her watch again.
"Make sure Enoch's in position."
All her righteous had biblical combat call signs. She no longer recalled or even cared what their real names were. When she got back to the pavilion, all she had to do was accept 2 new replacements into her cadre. They would become the new Ephraim and Asher. Real names offered the danger of actual emotional attachment, and Eve was done with that. Forever. The righteous served her and entertained her. They kept her from screaming into her pillow every night. They were also without emotional challenge. Eve felt nothing for any of them, not even when they made her come screaming. It was sensation, not emotion. Maybe once her network located Joe Ledger and brought him in chains to her, she'd feel something. Maybe after she skinned Joe Ledger, she'd allow herself to become alive again. God, the thing she wanted to do to Ledger before he died. She wanted to force-feed him Viagra and then fuck him as he coughed out his last breath. She wanted to stab him with every single one of the 206 knives she'd collected. Would that make the pain go away? Would it chase the shadows out of her mind? She didn't know. But she swore to herself she would find out. Who knew? Maybe she'd even be able to fall in love again. Though, as far as Eve believed, there would never be anyone she loved like she'd loved Adam. Poor Adam. He had saved her life. He'd been her life. And then Ledger had stolen him from her in Norway last December.
"Enoch's locked and loaded," Abel assured her, cutting into her thoughts.
She blinked, coming back to the moment.
Huh? What? Oh, good, good. And the choppers?
Inbound, ma'am. ETA 4 minutes. Eve measured out a tiny slice of a smile.
Good,
she said again. Chapter 104. Das Verarbeitungszentrum. The blast was big. A 1-2 punch that sent a tsunami of superheated gas racing after us. Ghost was faster and made it to the T-junction at the end of the hall a half step before I did. The heat caught me, though. It picked me up and hurled me through the air, but I twisted and curled and hit the floor rolling. The main fireball passed over me. It spread out along the ceiling on both sides of the T, dispersing and fading and then burning out completely, leaving all the walls scorched black. Ceiling tiles melted and rained down, and I had to roll around on the floor to put out fires on my goddamn fire-resistant body armor. I'd never seen a blast like that before. If we hadn't run as fast and as far as we did, we'd have been reduced to ash. Ghost whimpered, terrified. He began to get up, but I snapped at him to stay down. Despite the pain in every molecule of my body, I got up into a low crouch and scuttled like a half-cooked crab to peer around the corner. The hall in front of cell 13 was gone, burned and shattered, with sections of the roof leaning drunkenly down. The paint on the walls closer to the blast was burning sluggishly, though most of the flames had been extinguished by the blast. There was no sign of the two men. They had literally been blown to bits. And those bits still burned. I straightened and stood for a moment, trying to understand everything that had happened in the last 2 minutes. Forcing myself to make credible statements of practical analysis, despite the wreckage inside my head, old and new, I needed to be in the moment to understand this. A team of some kind had attacked the processing plant. Who they were or what their agenda might be was unclear. Certainly not regular military. Now, these cats had to be PMCs on the payroll of someone who wanted to free one or more prisoners. They'd mentioned the Spaniard. Did that mean these guys were fixers? If so, it meant that they were enhanced fixers wearing ultra-sophisticated body armor that exploded when the men wearing them died. Yeah, find a comfortable chair for that to sit in. I glanced at Ghost, who was spattered with blood and soot. Well, I said, it's finally happened. The world's now officially crazier than I am. For no damned reason at all, he wagged his tail. He's a weird damn dog. The gunfire was getting louder, but not closer. A hell of a battle was raging, and it was getting intenser. I tapped my tactical computer to bring up the feeds from the busy bees and saw that parts of the prison had become full-tilt war zones. There were bodies all over the place. Most of the cell doors had been torn open, literally ripped from their hinges, and the corpses of prisoners lay twisted and dead. I saw one man with a distinctly Somalian face and a torn orange jumpsuit trying to crawl away, but he left such a thick blood trail that I knew he wouldn't make it far. His left foot was missing. There were other bodies, too. Uniformed guards sprawled and dead, their limbs shattered, flesh ripped apart with a level of savagery that was appalling. Then the bees found the main source of the gunfire. It was the staff quarters. A handful of guards, possibly the only ones left, were crouched behind a stack of overturned tables and chairs. Some were dressed, but most were in underwear or pajamas. A dozen of their comrades lay dead around them. They were firing at four more of the armored fixers. I saw no fixer corpses anywhere and wondered if that accounted for some of the explosions. Did they all wear suicide vests? Was it some variation of the no man left behind concept? Incineration rather than recovery? Were the explosives tied to some kind of telemetry, likely a heartbeat? If so, how'd they ever convince any of the fixers to strap on those vests? I wanted needed to interrogate one of these spooky sons of bitches, but that presented its own set of problems. They were stronger and faster than I was, and there were a bunch of them. If I had Havoc Team with me, that math would be in my favor. Top, Bunny, Belle, and Andrea were a match for any squad of killers. At least I thought so. Backup plan was to exfil right damn now, locate their vehicle, and either plant a tracker or tail them. But there were a bunch of innocent folks fighting for their lives a few corridors away from where I stood. If I left now to save my own skin, I'd be leaving them to die. Inside my head, the darkness whispered bad things. Let them die, it told me. Saving them isn't the mission. Find Santoro, what else matters? It was as real as any voice I've ever heard. It was my own voice, painted black. Let them die. I would like to say that I was in no way tempted to do exactly that. To slip away in the smoke and confusion and stick to my goal. Saving these people fell under the heading of mission creep, adding to the scope of work I already had. It would put me in danger. It would put Ghost in danger. We might not even succeed in saving anyone and die in the process, leaving Santoro free to destroy more lives. More families. I watched the gun battle on the computer screen, and for a few brittle moments I saw my family there, standing to one side of the barricade, clustered together. Not watching the battle, they were all looking at me. I saw my father's lips move as if he were talking to me, but I couldn't hear what he was saying. Dad? I breathed. Dad, for God's sake, tell me what I should do. He stopped talking and just looked at me, and then, one by one, they turned their backs and walked away into the smoke. It came close to breaking me. Dad! I yelled, actually yelled it out loud. He thinks you're abandoning him, whispered the darkness. They all do. Tears, hot as acid, burned in my eyes. I looked down at Ghost. His gaze was dark and scalpel sharp. He bared his gleaming metal teeth. I holstered my dart gun, then released the magazine of the Sig Sauer, replacing it with a full one. Together, we ran into hell. Chapter 105. Das Verarbeitungszentrum. We used the smoke and confusion to move through the building following the gunfire. We came upon one of the processing plant's guards sprawled near another T-junction. He was torn apart. Literally. Both arms and his jaw had been savagely ripped from his body. It was a hideous thing to see, and I only prayed he'd at least died quickly. Around the corner, I found his partner. He sat against the wall with a gaping, ragged red hole where his throat should have been. It looked as if someone had taken a fistful of his windpipe and torn it out, discarding the mess by throwing it against a wall. There's killing in combat, and even a measure of savagery that sometimes happens in the heat of the fight. But this was a kind of malicious mayhem that spoke to a pernicious delight. These fixers were having fun, playing with whatever faux superpowers were granted them by their armor. Even so, it scared the absolute hell out of me. But it also made me angry. Really damned angry. Ghost growled low in his chest, not looking at the corpses, but glaring along the hall where bloody footprints showed the path the fixers had taken. Yeah, I told him quietly. Let's go get some. We kept moving, but as we drew close to the sounds of battle, I slowed our pace so I could check the feed from the busy bees. It looked like the guards were currently holding their own, and I could see why. Two of them had pump shotguns, and the big chunks blown out of the doorframe and walls told me these were loaded with slugs, what hunters used to call pumpkin balls, heavy lead balls that my Uncle Jack liked for hunting wild boar. Other bullet holes in the metal frame, the ones that clearly punched all the way through, had to be armor-piercing. That kind of ordnance had stopped the fixers, for the moment. Clearly none of those PMCs had been killed, because there was no sign of explosions, though I wondered if some of the other blasts I'd heard were from more successful counterattacks. I angled some of the bee swarm to focus on the fixers. One of them had his goggles off, and I let a bee hover to get a good look at him. The camera was small and didn't have great definition, but it was clear enough to tell me a lot. His eyes were wide, staring, the whites stained with red and incredibly dilated pupils. Bloody tears streaked those parts of his cheeks I could see, blood mingling with the sweat boiling from his skin. He looked like the kind of junkie who had taken too much of too many different kinds of stimulants and was way, way out on the edge. Proof that these fixers were not only enhanced but strung out by it. I looked at my pistol for a moment and then holstered it. Plan B, I told Ghost, and then spent a few seconds activating the other half of my swarm, the killer bees. Wish I had the time to swap Sandman out of their dischargers and replace it with something a lot more toxic, but I hadn't planned on doing any harm at all to the staff here. No way I could have anticipated that the place would be hit by a full team of PMCs. Was it a coincidence? Or had the guy I got the Casanova intel from broken his promise to me and confessed to Santoro? That would make logical sense, but it didn't feel right. Something about this whole thing was freaky, which meant there was a lot I didn't know. Which meant that the Sandman might be useful to me after all. I hastily typed new orders into the swarm software. First, I told the busy bees to engage their laser targeting systems and paint each fixer. Then I sent the killer bees to follow and sting. I crouched next to Ghost and watched. The fixers didn't notice the bees coming, not with all the noise and smoke, but then the swarm struck. There was very little exposed skin on them, but they each wore a balaclava, which is thin, flexible cloth. I sent the killer bees smashing into their cheeks and throats and lips. Maybe only 1 in 4 hit true and hit well enough to penetrate the material, but it only takes one sting for Sandman to drop them, and the fixers began to fall. Booyah, I murmured. Ghost answered with a soft woof. I gave it 4 seconds, and then I broke into a run, drawing my knives as I rounded the last corner. Half the fixers were down, and I was both astonished and horrified to see that they were not out. Somehow, they were managing to fight the effects of the damned drug, and that was supposed to be impossible. I'd never once seen Sandman fail. Sandman was the latest version of a compound originally designed to knock down grizzly bears so rangers could transport them away from campers and homes. It should have had every single one of those pricks unconscious before they hit the floor. Should have. I used Q1 to cycle through the radio channels until I found the one for the security team. I yelled to the guards behind the barricade, telling them not to shoot, that I was a friendly. I yelled in German and in English. I had to repeat it several times before the gunfire slowed and then stopped. I had the Snellig in one hand and a knife in the other as I moved into the group of fixers, all of whom were darted now. 2 still stood, but they were swaying drunkenly, their weapons hanging from loose hands and slack fingers. Ghost raced past me and jumped at one of them, catching a wrist and dragging the man down. His teeth crunched audibly through bone. "Ghost, own," I yelled, wanting that man injured but not dead. Own was not a command to be nice, though, and I heard the wolf that lives inside my dog snarl with savage glee. And let's face it, over the last month, he'd been getting a lot of practice. I went for the other one, bashing aside his gun barrel and then kicking him in the knee. It took 2 good kicks to destroy the joint, and then I ripped his goggles off and smashed the bridge of his nose with the pommel of the heavy knife. Cartilage and the lip of nasal bone exploded, flooding his eustachian tubes with blood, likely blinding him with the shooting stars of photopsia. I hit him again, this time on the temple, and then again once he was down. Then I whirled as two guards with shotguns began creeping out from their place of concealment. "Listen to me," I roared in German. "These men are wearing suicide vests that will detonate if they die. We need to disable and restrain them. I shot them with tranquilizers." One of the guards hurried out, looked at the men groaning and crawling around on the floor, and then he raised the barrel and pointed it at me.
"Drop your weapon," he ordered. "Did you hear what I said? I'm a friendly."
"Drop your weapon or I will kill you," he growled.
"Fuck me blind and move the furniture," I snarled. "I don't have time for this." I snapped off a Sandman dart that took him in the chest. He went right down, the shotgun falling to the ground before he could pull the trigger. Then I wheeled and pointed the Snellig at his partner, whose gun was still aimed at the fixers. "Sorry," I said, and shot him too. There was no win here, not for me anyway. I barked a command at Ghost. He disengaged with a great show of reluctance, but now the other guards were surging out from behind the stack of tables. This was going south too fast. "Out," I snapped, and together we fled. Even while we ran, I kept yelling at them to not kill the fixers because of the bomb triggers synced with heartbeats. But their response was to open fire on me. We dove for the first turning in the hall as a fusillade pocked chips of stone from the walls. I sincerely hoped the guards would try to cuff and arrest those dazed fixers rather than do something suicidal like pop caps in them as a way of getting revenge. I hoped that professionalism would trump the need to avenge their fellow guards. Chapter 106. Das Verarbeitungszentrum.
"Miss Eve," said Abel, "we have movement."
The two fixers raised their rifles and took up shooting positions facing the destroyed entrance. Smoke swirled inside, but now shadows moved within the clouds. Eve slipped a Glock 19 from a hip holster and stood between the two men, making no attempt to find cover. She did not see Cain and Abel share a quick glance. Abel began to say something, but Cain shook his head. There was a squawk of static, and then a voice spoke on the comms unit.
"Jedediah to command, coming out the front with the package."
"Come ahead," responded Abel.
The shadows resolved into figures, two of the team bulky in their body armor, helmets, and equipment. They held handguns and used their free hands to support a very thin man who wore only a chest protector and helmet with a blacked-out visor. The thin man wore prison coveralls and slip-on boat shoes. His wrists were zip-cuffed and he stumbled, though from injury, shock, or weakness was uncertain. The fixers hustled him out of the building and ran to the shelter formed by the parked truck. There they turned him around and leaned him back against the vehicle. Eve hurried over and watched as Abel quickly checked the prisoner for injuries. Then Cain removed the blackout helmet to reveal a white man with a scraggly beard and terrified eyes.
"We verified ID with fingerprint and retina scan," said Jedediah. "This is he."
Eve smiled like a happy kid on Christmas morning. She bent forward and kissed the man on the mouth, which shocked the prisoner, but not the fixers. They were used to her random impulses by now.
"Dr. Dejan Bruzovic," she said,
mangling the Croatian pronunciation. It came out as Bruzovic. The man blinked in fear and uncertainty.
Who are you?" stammered Brozovic. "What is this?"
"This is a rescue, sugar."
"I don't understand."
Eve leaned close.
"We're the White Knights come to save you from the deep, dark dungeons."
"Who are you?"
demanded Brozovic.
Let's just say Kuga sends his regards.
Brozovich's eyes widened. He echoed the name, then smiled with tremendous relief.
Thank God.
Thank me,
corrected Eve.
I thought they were going to let me rot in there.
Oh, no, sweet cheeks, we need you, Eve said. We've had some issues with the R-33.
You've been using it?
He gasped.
It's still unstable.
She beamed.
Well, no shit, Sherlock. Why do you think we're galloping to the rescue? It's not your boyish charm.
Brozovich looked at the building and then at Cain and Abel.
You're fixers,
he said, peering at their faces.
You're not using R-33. Your eyes...
Abel ignored him and touched his comms unit. There was another explosion inside the processing plant.
Jubal is offline, Abel said.
Dipshit,
said Eve, then turned back to Brozovich.
We're getting you out of here, honey buns. Kuga and Daddy have very big plans for you.
Daddy?
Echoed Brozovich. Cain gave the scientist a small shove.
She means Raphael Santoro. Now shift your ass.
Eve just laughed. Chapter 107. Das Verarbeitungszentrum. Ghost and I hurried through the smoke back to the door through which we'd first entered. A good portion of that part of the prison was in ruins now, so we simply exited through a hole in the wall. We ran low and fast for the fence, and I only paused when I saw a group of three people standing outside the main entrance. Two fixers, big ones, real brutes, and a slender blonde woman. I skidded to a stop and turned, clawing my binoculars from a pouch on my belt. My fingers were trembling so badly I dropped it, but then I had it pressed to my eyes as I adjusted the focus. It was she. Eve, goddamn. Even without the leg brace over the knee I'd put a bullet through, I'd have recognized her anywhere. Eve. Raphael Santoro's little pet. She called him Daddy. She loved him, had killed for him, had become his star pupil in the game of brutal extortion. She and her ex-lover Adam had managed to forcibly corrupt Navy SEALs and turned them into mass murderers. While trying to shoot me, Eve had accidentally killed Adam. I'd made a critical mistake by not putting my bullet into Eve's brain pan instead of her knee. Every life she destroyed from now on was on me as much as her. And here she was, with a squad of spooky-ass, enhanced fixers. Had she known I was going to be here? Or was this one of those coincidences that make me believe the whole universe is run by demented gods? As I watched, three more figures came out, a pair of fixers half-dragging, half-carrying a prisoner in an orange jumpsuit. I swapped a new magazine into my Snellig and then tapped keys to bring the swarms of bees out so I could stage another assault. I could hear police sirens in the distance, but not too close. Maybe I could take out the fixers and drag Eve off to a quiet spot for a little game of truth or consequences. But before I could even begin to formulate a plan, the air was chopped by the whoop-whoop-whoop of helicopters coming in low and fast. I turned to peer into the night sky, hoping they were also police, or maybe a military sent in response to alarms from the processing plant. They weren't. A pair of unmarked black choppers came roaring out of the night. One was a muscular NH-90 medium troop transport, and the other was a deadly UH Tiger that bristled with rocket pods, chain guns, and missiles. I may be crazy, but I'm not that crazy. This wasn't a fight I could win. Ghost made low growling sounds of frustration. He knew it too. So instead, I set some busy bees to get pictures of Eve and the prisoner. We waited until the bees completed their task. I collected them, and then Ghost and I vanished into the night. Chapter 108. The Talk, Phoenix House, Amphorae Island, Greece. Doc Holliday was not done with her presentation.
What we don't yet know is where and how they plan to use this tech, she said. As of right now, they could walk right into any venue, any stadium, any public office, or hell, even any military base and destroy it.
Do we think the fixers know they're wearing what amounts to suicide vests? She thought about it and then shook her head.
I'd have to say no. I mean, why on earth would they strap it on knowing that they were that completely disposable? Remember, the Kuga organization isn't a religious or political movement. They're basically the mafia on steroids. Criminals are not known for heroic sacrifice. They don't want to die for a cause. They want to get rich, get fat, screw down and marry up, and retire old. PMCs are no different. They take risks because it's a job that pays them for that. But in the end, they want to be able to spend that money.
Maybe we can find some way to tell them, said Bug. If they stage a hit, then I can try and hack into their comms systems.
That's good, said Wilson.
Unless the suits can be remote detonated, said Coleman.
Thank you, Debbie Downer, said Doc.
Ron is correct, said Church. It's doubtful Kuga would make the critical error of sending his troops out without a failsafe. He really only needs them to get into position. Whatever collateral damage they inflict with guns and grenades amounts to theater. The real goal would be to destroy a very specific target, either for maximum body count or to make a point.
Like what? Asked Isaac. Walking into the United Nations?
They're diplomats, said Wilson. Parliament or the Capitol building are more effective targets, or the White House.
Agreed, said Church. But we need to consider non-political targets, or targets of a military nature.
Yes, said Wilson slowly. If, say, they sold that tech to the Kurds, and had a couple of them go after Assad's palace.
Or to Palestinians, said Isaac. Or to Israelis, for that matter.
His preeminent buyer would likely be underdogs in any political or military conflict, said Church. If ISIL wanted to make a comeback, for example, or the Taliban, there are endless possibilities, and any one successful strike becomes a catalog page to sell this technology to the next 50 buyers. Being apolitical, Kuga can sell to both parties in any conflict.
Then we are in real trouble, said Coleman.
Yes, we damn well are, said Doc, and Church nodded. I really, really, really hate to ask this, said Nikki. But is there more, and please say no?
Doc Holliday gave her a smile as bright as the noonday sun.
Why, sweetie, of course there's more.
Chapter 109. The Talk, Phoenix House, Amphori Island, Greece.
Now we get to the areas where we don't know much for certain, said Doc Holliday.
She clicked to change the image. This one showed a collage of several documents with handwritten notes or post-its, each with a different acronym. Doc used her laser pointer to tick them off one at a time.
The most commonly repeated code is AO, she said. There's also a few references to the AO or TAO, which is probably the same thing. Based on the Croatia documents, we had very little to go on, but in the notes Joe gave to Toys, there are references to the American operation.
Which is? Asked Wilson.
Beats the living tarnation out of me, Ducky.
We can conjecture that it involves a deployment of the other technology, said Church.
Sure, but how can we pinpoint the target? Asked Isaac.
Without a time frame, we cannot, Church said glumly. We're early in the summer, and with COVID restrictions lifting, baseball season will continue in earnest, with sentimental fans now flocking to the stadiums. The same goes for concerts, and there are outdoor events like Coachella, Burning Man, and many others. If we go into fall, there's football season, schools reopening, election rallies.
He let the rest hang.
Moving on, said Doc. There are a few references to G-55. Isaac thinks it's another product line that we don't have specs on yet. Ronnie Bear thinks it's a code for a generation of a bioweapon, but we're just guessing.
They all batted theories around, but again, the lack of context foiled them.
Then we have R-33, said Doc. That is a chemical, and there were extensive notes in the Croatia papers. There were even some samples of earlier versions of it, notably R-16 and R-31, but I'll let Woolly Bear tell you his theory.
Ronald Coleman got to his feet. He was relatively new to Rogue Team International and not used to giving presentations to Church and his chief of operations, but he took a breath and plunged in. I have a theory about R-33, he began. There are several references to R-33, Relentless, and the 33 protocols in the notes we recovered in Croatia, and I believe they're all the same thing.
Excuse me, said Wilson, but Relentless?
Yes, it appears to be a category of designer drug therapies in the eugeroic category, what some people call nootropic. Wakefulness drugs. Modafinil is the best-known drug in this category of drugs. It was developed to work for people with narcolepsy. It's now used in all kinds of contexts where people need to stay alert for long periods of time. The Air Force uses it as a go pill for certain situations. They did a really interesting test where they kept pilots awake for 37 hours and made them fly in a simulator under the influence of it. That has real benefits for the military on long missions. And I know that it's been tested in some countries to help firefighters on long shifts, emergency room staff, and so on. There are clear benefits, but as with all drugs, there are both known side effects and potential misuses. Not accidental. I mean, deliberate uses for less than admirable purposes. He paused to make sure everyone was following. They were. There's a mention in the old DMS files of a case you worked on, Mr. Church, and which was later completed by Joe Ledger. At different times, you were hunting for black marketeers moving a performance-enhancing synthetic steroid, the first generation of a formula that combines the select lean mass-building steroids with a synthetic eugeroid compound that significantly increases and regulates the hypothalamic histamine levels. In normal pharmacology, these drugs are wakefulness-promoting agents often prescribed to prevent shift work sleepiness. That version was designed to build stamina and wakefulness to a point where the treated person won't tire and won't lose mental sharpness.
How does that work? Asked Wilson.
While these drugs do upregulate hypothalamic histamine, they more directly work as a dopamine reuptake inhibitor, which means that they keep dopamine in the brain from being reabsorbed into the signaling neurons. This has the effect of building up more dopamine in the synaptic space, which is the business end of a neuron. Now, this works really well for what it is intended to do. A situation where you have to be okay for a long period of time, but not one where you have to be super awesome for a short period of time. Follow me?
What does this have to do with Kuga? Asked Nikki.
Getting there. Coleman took a drink from a bottle of water. One problem with most of these drugs is that they take 2 to 3 hours to kick in, and it's sort of a gradual and subtle effect. Per the Air Force study, there is still a 15 to 30% decrease in performance. However, we were able to obtain sufficient material from Croatia to subject it to GCMS and found 4 distinct compounds: L-DOPA, tetracycline, N-methylamphetamine hydrochloride, and oxycodone. The last 2 are in the sub-milligram to low-milligram range per injection. Really not enough to get someone high, and certainly not enough to cause super-strength and hyper-aggressive behavior. But they are the only parts of the concoction that make any sense right now. Bug raised his eyebrows.
So, these cats are loading up on meth and oxys?
Coleman said. In a way. And methamphetamine hydrochloride, or meth, has a long history of being used in combat situations. During World War II, the Nazis gave it out like candy to their soldiers. It was distributed under the name Pervitin. By the end of the war, they had created a pill code named D9. It contained the 5 milligrams of cocaine, 3 milligrams of Pervitin, and 5 milligrams of oxycodone. R-33 seems to be a continuation of that work. Church asks, what about the other components? L-DOPA is a dopamine precursor that is used in the treatment of Parkinson's disease, said Coleman. And the tetracycline is a common antibiotic. But let me get to the really key part here. Among the recovered materials was this. Coleman held up a small white packet about half the size of a business card and less than half an inch thick. According to their clinical records, something like this is intended to be surgically implanted just beneath the skin of each fixer. And this is an expanded polytetrafluoroethylene pouch that contains hundreds of millions of cells.
What type of cells? Asked Church.
Well, you see, boss, that's the really interesting part. RNA-seq showed that they were most likely chromaffin cells. Those are the cells in the adrenal cortex that are responsible for the release of catecholamines.
Began Wilson, fumbling with it. Coleman stepped right in.
Catecholamines are the molecules responsible for the body's fight or flight response, which was interesting by itself. But when we dug down and did whole genome sequencing, we found a number of genetically inserted TET-ON promoters. Specifically, they were attached to inserted versions of dopa decarboxylase, dopamine beta hydroxylase, and phenylethylamine N-methyltransferase.
I have no idea what that means.
Coleman, who was in gear and very excited, tried to scale it down, but he was a lab rat and very rarely had to explain these things to ordinary mortals. TET-ON promoters are a little bit of DNA that can be used to control when a gene is expressed. Think of it as a light switch for a gene. But this switch is flipped by adding tetracycline. It has been used in biotechnology for a long time, but this isn't just some off-the-shelf version. This is highly specialized to turn on very fast and make huge amounts of the genes. And the genes they control are the genes in the synthetic pathway to turn L-DOPA into norepinephrine and adrenaline.
But, fumbled Nikki, why put the cells in the pouches? Why not just inject them somewhere into the PMC?
Because the pouch protects the cells from the immune system of the person it is implanted into, so there is no rejection, explained Coleman. The pouch lets small molecules and liquid back and forth, but it doesn't allow cells in or out. There's a clinical trial underway right now where similar technology is being used to encapsulate insulin-secreting cells to treat type 1 diabetes. However, in this case, they are using the pouches as small bioreactors to make huge amounts of norepinephrine and adrenaline, but only in the presence of tetracycline. L-DOPA is a synthetic precursor for those hormones, so that makes sense too.
Okay, Nikki said. I think I actually understood that part. Still clinging on by my fingernails. Wilson said under his breath.
So the capsules under the skin are filled with cells that have been engineered so that the presence of this antibiotic causes them to create huge amounts of norepinephrine and adrenaline. The combination of those two hormones is what is believed to cause hysterical strength. That's the kind of thing where a mom lifts a car off her baby or whatever.
Isn't there a great physical cost to that kind of sudden exertion? Asked Church.
Oh, yes, said Coleman, very much. Especially with this relentless series of drugs. If they use this for any significant length of time, it'll probably kill them. The heart is not designed to take such a huge and sustained